Maine Attorney General Aaron Frey. As Maine's chief legal officer, Attorney General Aaron Frey oversees a large portfolio, including the prosecution of homicides and felony drug cases, protecting consumers against fraud, civil rights enforcement, defending the state in major court cases, and more. Frey, a former criminal defense attorney and legislator, was first elected as Maine Attorney General in 2018. A major focus of his office has been the opioid crisis. His office now issues quarterly fatal and non-fatal drug overdose reports and was part of the lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, from which Maine will receive $20 million. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Attorney General Frey talks about opioid response, the backlog in criminal prosecutions, public funding to religious schools, cash bail, the Penobscot River, and more. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The state's top legal officer joins us today to discuss the many issues he's dealing with in Maine, from opioid-related concerns to tribal rights to criminal justice. Aaron Frey is Attorney General for the state of Maine, currently serving his second two-year term. He is a lawyer and former legislator in Maine's House of Representatives, and he's from Bangor. Aaron, thanks for joining us for Maine Calling today.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we invite you and the audience to ask questions and send comments to our Attorney General. You can email a brief email, please, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, find us on Facebook or Instagram, or, of course, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Aaron Frey, I understand that, like everyone else, your offices and work are just starting to emerge from the pandemic. How has the pandemic affected your office and everything that comes under it?
Well, you know, when we were first entering the pandemic, I thought that this was going to be an opportunity to take a breath, catch up on some of those projects that were not able to be gotten to during 2019. And boy, did I underestimate the fact that different work was going to be replacing the work that couldn't be done because of the pandemic. We had a fair amount of litigation around the executive branch management of the pandemic over the last year. We had litigation around voting rights and access to the ballot box to make sure people could access the ballot box. USPS was, you know, making it hard for people to cast their vote. So that replaced the work that I thought that we weren't going to have. But at the same time, there were a number of efficiencies that allowed work to be done better, right? So, you know, boards and commissions started meeting remotely. And so our AAGs didn't skip a beat in terms of the representation they were able to add. We are at the point now, though, that some of the cases that could not be addressed because they required in-person hearings. So, for example, homicide prosecutions, different kinds of high level criminal cases. We are now just getting back on track at being able to prosecute those cases, you know, making sure that the defendant has their day in court and the state proves its burden. And so the homicide cases in particular have been used to start the court back opening up starting last fall. It has been such a tireless process, a lot of really talented people in my office, in the court system, defense attorneys have worked really hard to help us emerge from, you know, what became a remote practice over the last year to reopening, which is what we're experiencing right now.
Sure. I read, Aaron, that there are thousands and thousands, perhaps 10,000 cases in a backlog right now. Is that accurate?
That is correct. The courts have been doing the best they can to adapt their technology to, you know, hold as many hearings as they could that were appropriate for remote proceedings. But when it comes to actually having people come into the courtroom, whether it be for, you know, some kind of conference or some sort of trial, where it's really important that the public have access, that, you know, there'd be full confrontation rights, that the state put on its full case, not only are there, just less than 40 homicide cases that need to be prosecuted from my office's perspective, but across the state, DA's offices, district attorney's offices, have a number of cases that, because they required some type of in-person court appearance, just couldn't be reached.
So what does this mean? Are people staying in jail, in prison, longer than they might be awaiting trial?
No, there's been a lot of work through the pandemic, and I want to give a lot of credit in particular to the district attorney's offices, to defense attorneys, to the courts, to law enforcement agencies. There's been a lot of work to ensure that, you know, particularly for cases that are being held up where, we're not talking homicides, we're talking, you know, driving offenses, we're talking, you know, maybe minor assaults, you know, thefts. There's been a lot of work to make sure that folks are not waiting in jail while their case is pending. And in particular, the courts have been very mindful of this for two reasons, right? One, because it really wouldn't be appropriate to be holding somebody for a long period of time on a case that, you know, maybe wouldn't even end up with a jail sentence anyway. But the other reason is for public safety. You know, putting people in jail during the pandemic had its own hosts of risks. And so prosecutors, defense attorneys, the courts were really mindful of this. And it has not been my impression that there's a large number of people who are sitting in jail who maybe shouldn't be as a result of the court backlog.
I understand it's going to depend on several things, and the biggest being that Maine's case count remains low. But given that it appears we're coming out of the pandemic, how long do you think it will take to catch up on the backlog?
Well, I hesitate to make a guess because I might scare people. I think it's anticipated that it's going to take, you know, one, two, maybe more years to really get through all of the cases to get back to normal, right? What would be considered normal. But that depends, right? A lot of cases right now are clogged up on what we would call the jury trial list, right? So individuals who have said, I want to have a trial, either in front of a jury, in front of a judge. My experience as a private practitioner, you know, because I used to practice privately before I became attorney general, I'd have clients that would spend a lot of time reviewing the evidence, assessing their options. When it came time to pick that jury or it came time to have that trial scheduled, the calculus changed and maybe the trial was no longer needed. So, you know, there's going to be a number of different ways that some of these cases end up wrapping up short of a trial. It's hard to put a percentage to that. And again, I think maybe year, 2 years is when we really start getting back to what would be considered more manageable dockets.
Let me ask you about the opioid crisis. I know tomorrow is the governor's summit, the third annual. You all, your office has been changing the way it collects and disseminates information about opioid overdoses. Tell us what you've changed and why.
So for a while now, the office has provided quarterly reporting on those individuals who have succumbed to a drug overdose, right? The fatal overdoses. Beginning this year, we thought that there really is more value, not only in making sure that there are more timely numbers for the public consumption about how many people were experiencing a fatal overdose, but that there was also other information that may be of some value relating to non-fatal overdoses, so that, you know, the public could have a more real-time understanding of how it is that, you know, those who were dealing with overdoses, you know, what that looked like in Maine. So all this information is posted up on MaineDrugData.org. We've been doing the best we can to get information out as timely as possible. So we've been providing monthly fatal overdose numbers. We've been providing monthly non-fatal overdose numbers. We've been providing some information about some of the trends that we are seeing. Our hope, and this has been in collaboration with the administration, by the way, because there's a number of different individuals who are working hard to pull this information together. You know, the hope is that this provides information that individuals can more timely react to, you know, whether it be family, friends of those who are you know, at risk of experiencing an overdose, whether it be fatal or non-fatal, for community providers, treatment providers, law enforcement, policymakers. You know, our hope is that this information enriches how it is that we can better address the opioid crisis, with the goal being, you know, one person dying from an overdose, one person experiencing a non-fatal overdose is one too many. And the more information we can put out there, driving people, encouraging people, reminding people of this opioid crisis, our hope is that this more timely release of information will do that.
Aaron, there's a lot of discussions about the way in which our society even looks at drug use and abuse. And I know even before the Maine legislature this year, some bills that would have decriminalized opioid use. What is your stance on those bills and on maybe taking a different approach generally, as not just in the court system, but as a society, towards opioids?
Well, so there was at least three different pieces of legislation that that drew a lot of my focus. It was important that we decriminalize possession of hypodermic apparatuses, needles, right? Decriminalize paraphernalia. You know, so somebody might have a spoon that's associated with their drug use or a needle. You know, there's no reason to be charging for that behavior, right? That's and so that was an important progress. I appreciated the opportunity to be involved at holding the state to a higher burden when proving trafficking or furnishing of either heroin or fentanyl. The way the law used to read was that if a person had a certain amount of heroin or a certain amount of fentanyl, just based on that amount, they could be charged with trafficking or furnishing. And all that the state had to do was show the amount. You know, now, because of a change in the law that I supported and that I appreciate that others worked hard on, you know, in order for the state to prove trafficking and furnishing, you know, we have to put on evidence that would also go to the intent of the person to do that. So we did what's called putting in a presumptive inference. It allows the state to put on evidence that might show that they possessed a certain amount to traffic in heroin or furnish in heroin or fentanyl. But the defendant will have the ability to say, no, this was just for possession. And a jury would have to consider that. That wasn't the case before. It's the case now. That was an important reform. On decriminalization of drugs generally, I did take the position that this was just not the appropriate time to completely decriminalize possession of drugs. And what I told the committee, what I maintain today is I don't think jail is the answer to addressing the opioid crisis. I don't think that fines are the answer to addressing the opioid crisis. You know, presently I see the criminal, you know, law enforcement as one of the many interventions that may be involved in helping direct a person down a healthier path or path that gets them on the other side of their drug use. In order to get to decriminalization, I really think that work needs to be done to ensure that we have some intervention available to support that person. So for example, in Oregon, Oregon is the only state in the nation right now that had a voter referendum to decriminalize possession of drugs. In addition to the decriminalization, there was a second part of that referendum that put a lot of resources into treatment availability. So if in order to move down the path of decriminalization, removing the criminal justice system from being some sort of intervention along with many other interventions, we really need to make sure that we have a robust treatment system that we can be directing people to through that process. So that, I mean, that's what I expressed to the committee. That's where I stand today. So that those are my thoughts.
And I know you're part of the Opioid Summit, the Governor's Opioid Summit, tomorrow being held online. Joining us now on the line is Kirk Francis, who is chief of the Penobscot Nation. Thanks for calling in, Chief Francis.
Hey, thank you. Good morning. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chief.
I understand the Penobscot Nation has been trying for almost a decade to assert its rights to the Penobscot River, and a federal appeals court just ruled against that. Can you sum up why this is so important? And also, what comes next now?
Well, thank you for the question. And we obviously, the Penobscot River is deeply tied to the Penobscot people in terms of our cultural identity. You know, since time immemorial, you know, we've relied on it. We've had a relationship with it. The tribe actually considers it a citizen formally in our laws. And so what's really at stake in that case from the tribal point of view is the ability to protect and to, you know, the sustenance-based lifestyle, subsistence-based lifestyle of Penobscot people, which is at the very core of our identity. So we feel like without the ability to really have a meaningful say in that issue in terms of how resources are being taken, how they're being protected, how it's being regulated, all of those things. What is the appropriate water quality standard from a human health criteria with very high consumption rates amongst tribal people? So really, it's a real cultural identity issue for the tribe in maintaining, you know, these ancient practices and ways and lifestyles that kind of make us who we are. So it's, you know, as all litigation gets rooted in a lot of different things. But for us, I think it's really about ensuring that there's a future for future generations to be Penobscot and their birth given right to do so. So it's really about much more than simply fishing or who gets to control what. So that's with the First Circuit decision this past week, we're obviously extremely disappointed. We believe that, you know, in the 3-2 decision that the two dissenting arguments are right in line with the way we're thinking. And so we're still kind of regrouping on the decision and figuring out our next steps and what we can do to try to get to a place where we're having a more, like I say, meaningful say in keeping our connection to the river. And you know, that's a territory that's 60 something miles of the main stem of the Penobscot River that growing up, I was always told was part of the reservation. People before me were, and now all of a sudden there's claims that it's not. So it's a stressful time, but you know, we're going to pick ourselves up and figure out, you know, what our path forward is from here.
Sure. Attorney General Aaron Frey, I know that you inherited this long time issue, and I wanted to know what your reaction is to the federal court decision and where you hope what you hope happens now.
Well, you know, certainly as the chief indicated, you know, the when you get to litigation, the tough part is that, you know, that's where, you know, the third branch of government is resolving differing views. And it is very rare in my practice that everybody would walk away happy from a decision, right? So ideally, you know, we have a really engaged group of policymakers and individuals. You know, the tribal chiefs and the tribal attorneys have been working hard with members of the legislature, you know, working with communication with the governor's office. You know, the path forward here is, you know, to the extent that we have differing views on what the law provides for now, it increases the importance of policymakers looking at the law and making changes that are more consistent with, you know, the important sovereign interests of those tribes that we have here in Maine, and the state interests. And I know that there was a fair amount of work over the last legislative session. I know the chief was directly involved. He was a very integral part of a task force on changes to the Maine Indian Claim Settlement Act. Him and others, somebody from my office who sat on that task force who was able to offer some input. You know, my hope is that conversations that have occurred that are ongoing will yield some way to resolve these different points of view, so that really we can be focused on ways that we can be supportive of the legitimate sovereign interests of the tribes and the legitimate interests of the state.
Chief Francis, before I let you go, anything you'd like to say to or about Attorney General Aaron Frey before we go to our break?
Yes. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for those comments and for being on. I would just say that the Attorney General points out, they sat at the table from the very beginning. Most recently, we saw the gaming bill. The AG's office was very engaged in that process throughout the last couple of years. That bill actually derived from the task force meetings and task force materials. So very comprehensive meetings. Our lawyers, their lawyers, they've spent a lot of time together over the past couple of years. And so we're very appreciative of the office's engagement in that. Of course, you know, it's disappointing where the governor ended up at the end of the day on that bill. We thought it was a very good bill that actually acknowledged state and tribal interests and processes. But I just would close by saying, you know, we've appreciated the engagement. I think it's the most engagement from that office I've seen in my 15 years as tribal chief. The outcome wasn't what we wanted, but at the end of the day, everybody, I think, was working in good faith to find a good product.
Well, and I appreciate you calling in for today's program. That was Chief Kirk Francis of the Penobscot Nation. It is time to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Naturopathic Health. Focused on individually oriented and minimally invasive healthcare, naturopathicme.com. And Bar Harbor Music Festival, celebrating its 55th season with live performances through July 25th. Schedule at barharbormusicfestival.org. And Springtide Seaweed, dedicated to offering Maine organically farmed seaweed. Learn more at springtideseaweed.com.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, we re-examine the possibilities and failures of carbon offsets.
If the system works perfectly, then every carbon credit cancels out a real ton of CO2 that is emitted. And when the system doesn't work perfectly, you end up with a net increase in CO2 emissions.
Clearing the air on carbon offsets on the next Climate One.
That's coming up today at 2 on Maine Public Radio. The 24th Maine International Film Festival is underway in Waterville, Skowhegan, and online. The festival features the best of American, independent, and international cinema and spotlights some of Maine and New England's most innovative filmmakers. Maine Public is a media sponsor of this year's festival, and Maine Public members are eligible for a special discount on tickets. For details on Maine International Film Festival and the Maine Public member discount, please visit MainePublic.org and click on events.
Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking with Maine's Attorney General, Aaron Fry, about the top issues his office is involved with. You can share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, find us on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Aaron, we had to go to a break after we talked to Chief Francis. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I just want to highlight that in terms of this ongoing conversation, the governor's office, members of the legislature, tribal leaders, tribal attorneys, my office, we have a commitment to a plan over the summer into the fall, leading up to the second regular session, because there are some bills that address this relationship between the state and the tribes that are due up next session. You know, we have the policymakers and, you know, the support of the relevant attorneys to have a really robust conversation in this off time, using it as best we can, so that hopefully, hopefully that work can yield some really constructive results. So I wanted to highlight that the governor's office, legislature, tribes, everybody's going to be doing some hard work over the summer and fall for a constructive conversation.
Other big news this past week, we found out that Maine will receive $20 million because of our role in the Purdue Pharma settlement that you were very involved in, Attorney General Fry. Tell us what we know about how will that $20 million come to Maine and how will it be used?
So through a litigation that the state of Maine has been involved in, many others. We've been suing Purdue and the family that owns Purdue, the Sackler family, for some time. It's a bankruptcy case right now. the agreement would have money coming into the state of Maine over a 9-year period that is to be directed toward abatement purposes, which is really important, right? So this isn't money that's going to come in that's going to go to pay for roads or go to pay for, things that are unrelated to the crisis that was created by the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma. Because again, the reason that we have an opioid crisis, there's a direct line to the activities of Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. So as that money comes in, it's going to be directed out amongst state, municipal, county interests. Our hope or our work is that we'll have a board set up, a panel set up that will help make decisions about how that money can best be spent to abate the opioid crisis. Let me just add, by the way, that in terms of the money coming in, the other important parts of the settlement are that it allows for the publication of thousands, tens of thousands of documents involving the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma in exacerbating the opioid crisis. So that's going to be for the public to look at and to understand just how bad their activity was. But it also makes sure that the Sacklers come nowhere near the opioid, opioids again. Not ideal. Certainly love to see more happen to the Sacklers here for the role that they had in the opioid crisis. But in terms of making sure we get resources that we can get directed out, that's important. In terms of time frame, there's still some process that needs to be done in court to close out this settlement. My hope is that in the very near future, we'll be able to start seeing these resources come in to go towards abatement.
All right. Well, calling in now is Megan Sway, who is Policy Director for the ACLU of Maine. Thanks for joining us, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I know the ACLU is also involved in many issues that involve the Attorney General's office. Tell us some of the priorities for the ACLU at this moment.
Right now, we're really interested in reducing the state's reliance on the criminal legal system as a response to societal problems. So I know that you guys talked about earlier today this backlog of cases in the court system. And the majority of people arrested and imprisoned in Maine are there for low-level offenses, which are often related to poverty or unmet mental health needs. Being arrested and charged with a minor crime, whether or not you go to jail, can derail your life. Jail or prison time and then a criminal record create barriers to housing and employment and health care, which are the things that people need to get their lives on track. Prosecutors have enormous power to decide what cases to bring, what charges to bring, and when they offer what is called deferred dispositions or don't. Deferred disposition means that the outcome of the case is delayed until a person does what the prosecutor asks them to do, and if they successfully complete it, then the case will be dismissed. So prosecutors have a lot of power within the system. Even though they don't make the laws, they enforce the laws.
Sure. And, so Megan, is what you're saying that we don't need to have the legislature pass a bill, but that Aaron Frey's office, the Attorney General office, could direct attorneys throughout the system to do more deferred dispositions and find other solutions?
I think it needs to be both. The legislature needs to act, but also the Attorney General as the head prosecutor in the state, who under law is charged with consulting and advising prosecutors. He has a tremendous role in advising them and guiding them towards, if there's a 1 to 2 year wait for people to have their final day in court, do these cases really need to proceed? Is this the best use of our time and resources?
Sure. Aaron Frey.
First of all, good morning to Megan. She has been an excellent resource in helping me understand different issues over the legislative session and certainly during my time as Attorney General, and completely understand and in many ways agree that the criminal justice system is really not the best intervention. I would maintain it is a intervention, but not the best intervention and one worth moving away from. In terms of my ability to direct how all individuals across the state are prosecuted. Much of the work that would need to be done is at the in the DA's offices. So when we're talking about unlawful possession of drugs or some of those different charges that are related to a certain activity that, you know, whether it be we'll just criminal activity that might be associated with getting resources to find drugs. A lot of that is at the DA's level, and I have been engaged with DAs about how they can divert, you know, before a defendant even sees the courtroom, certainly where they can make different decisions about how they charge. Still a lot of work to be done there, but I guess I do want to be clear that my power may be more persuasive in this regard than it would be have the power to direct, which is why the legislature does continue to be an important place to set that policy. You know, because if my persuasive ability is not up to the task of getting DAs to treat these cases differently, the legislature certainly has a lot of power in directing that activity.
Megan, before we let you go, the legislature has passed recently a bill that's seen as the most stringent in the nation in terms of the use of facial recognition technology by law enforcement. What is your stand on the bill that was just passed and signed into law in Maine?
The ACLU is really proud of the state of Maine for passing this legislation. We're showing the rest of the country what it looks like when we, the people, are in control of our civil rights and civil liberties, not tech companies, not profits from artificial intelligence and other facial recognition technologies. So we are very much in support and very proud to lead this movement across the states.
All right. Well, Megan Sway is policy director of the ACLU in Maine. Thanks so much for calling in. And Attorney General Fry, how does the new facial recognition law affect what your office does and the way that your prosecutors will handle cases?
Candidly, I'm not sure that that's going to affect us in any remarkable way, at least in terms of the cases that I am aware of. We're not using facial recognition as part of the work. In fact, I'd have to double check the extent to which law enforcement was even allowed to use it by policy in the first place. You know, frankly, one of the few benefits of not having money for technology is that many agencies just didn't have the technology to do something like that. But this is a perfect example of where, agreeing that there are so many problems with the technology that it's very invasive. This is important work by the legislature to set that policy so that we have a consistent standard across the state, so that folks don't begin to look at how to use that technology.
All right. Well, joining us now is Representative Charlotte Warren. She's a Maine state legislator representing Hollowell, Manchester, and West Gardner, and is House Chair of the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee. Thanks so much for calling in, Representative Warren.
Thank you, Jennifer, for having me, and good afternoon to Attorney General Fry.
I'm going to circle back to talking about the opioid crisis in Maine. Talk to us about the legislation that passed and didn't pass and your stance on that.
Yes, thank you for the question. As Attorney General Fry referenced, we did have sort of three larger pieces of legislation, two of which passed, one having to do with decriminalizing possession of syringes, secondly, changing how folks can be charged, you know, based on the weight of the substance that they possess. And the third had to do with decriminalizing possession, simple possession of substances. And I just want to say that one of the things that I appreciate about Attorney General Fry is that he has been in the trenches. He served as a defense attorney. He understands substance use disorder and how it affected his clients and how it's affecting Maine. And I think what we heard him say even just a few minutes ago on your show is that he knows jail is not the answer and fines are not the answer. And, you know, I just look forward to seeing what the Attorney General puts forward in this second regular session starting in January to help us move folks away from jail and fines and the criminal justice system in general when we're talking about the disease of substance use disorder. And I know that Attorney General Frey has that experience and the intention, as we heard him say. So if that particular bill, if it's his assertion that we aren't ready right now for that particular bill, but we know that jail and fines aren't the answer, I'm looking for Attorney General Frey to lead us to what is the next answer. How do we start to save lives? As many of us know, we're losing 11 Mainers a week to overdose right now. So we can't just keep returning to the same old tricks. We have to figure out a way to change what we're doing. And I'm, you know, really looking forward to seeing what Attorney General Frey is going to propose and lead as we head into this next session.
Sure. Representative Warren, before we go, I want to ask you about another topic, and that's the debate over cash bail. I know that you are among those who wanted to eliminate cash bail altogether, and that has not happened. But there are changes in Maine's cash bail system now after this legislative session, correct? And can you explain what they are?
Absolutely. And I think that everyone in Maine would agree that people should not be sitting in jail just because they can't afford to get out. That I think is pretty well agreed upon. And so the changes that were made in this past session had to do with very low level. There was a lot of compromise and very low level misdemeanor crimes that do, in fact, make sure that you know, somebody who has the access to resources shouldn't be able to get out while someone else is sitting there waiting just for their case to be adjudicated, while they don't pose a public safety threat, and also while we're paying for them to have, you know, three square meals and their medical needs attended to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. So, you know, even a few years ago when we were talking about eliminating cash bail, people saw it as sort of a far away, maybe far out discussion. We really opened the door on that this past year. And so I think we will see, hopefully, a quick expansion on the elimination of cash bail, you know, expand to higher level crimes, et cetera, when we are not talking about public safety risk.
Well, Charlotte Warren, State Representative from District 84, thank you so much for calling in. And before we go to our break, Aaron Frey, I want to ask you about your stance on the elimination of cash bail.
So for the cases that the AG's office deals with, this is not an issue that really comes up very often. There has been a national movement to, you know, if somebody is going to have to be incarcerated, there really needs to be an important reason for that. And having been a defense attorney where I did have clients that despite my Herculean efforts, they were there because they had $100 cash bail or early on in my practice, the bail fee, right? The $60 bail fee that has to be paid. You know, if somebody couldn't pay that, then they were sitting in jail until they went before court. It is important that we move to the right use of our resources. Holding somebody in jail for a misdemeanor theft on $100 probably isn't the best use of resources. And I want to applaud the legislature. I want to applaud the DAs and defense attorneys who worked hard to have this conversation. And, you know, because folks like Representative Warren, like Megan Sway, right, like they worked really hard to move that ball down the field. And I think that's really good work that they're doing.
We are speaking with Attorney General Aaron Frey. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Lunder Foundation in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, who are bringing the museum to you online at colby.edu/museum. And Cape Integrative Health, committed to working with Medicare patients to treat chronic lower back pain with acupuncture. Learn more at capeintegrativehealth.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, a locally owned energy efficiency company with career opportunities available. Details at evergreenyourhome.com/careers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. After a long pandemic break, Caribbean countries are now welcoming cruise ships back to port. The region depends on tourism, but COVID-19 is far from over. Many locals are unvaccinated, so public health experts say cruise with caution. That's next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now is coming up at noon on Maine Public Radio. Balanced, in-depth coverage of local, state, and national politics is at the heart of public broadcasting, and keeping the electorate informed about the issues important to Maine is central to the mission of Maine Public. Maine's Political Pulse is a weekly discussion on the politics here at home with Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler. The Pulse can be heard on Fridays during All Things Considered, and it's also available as a weekly podcast and newsletter at mainepublic.org. You can have the Political Pulse newsletter delivered straight to your inbox on Friday mornings by subscribing at mainepublic.org/pulse.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we are talking with Maine's Attorney General, Aaron Fry. We'd love to have you join the conversation. What are your questions about the criminal justice system in Maine, consumer protection, and other topics? You can call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to Facebook or Instagram. Or just, again, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Attorney General Fry, my understanding is that Maine is the only state without a public defender system. Do you believe it's time for that to change? Do we need one?
Well, I want to be careful about what I suggest defendants should have for, because as the state's attorney, right, I don't want to be biased. Here's what I'd offer. It is so important that individuals who are charged with crimes, who are indigent, that their Sixth Amendment right to court-assigned counsel is fully realized. And there has been significant effort over the last many years in identifying where Maine could stand to improve to ensure high-quality legal defense for those who are indigent. But identifying some steps on how to get there. I want to applaud the legislature. I want to applaud the governor for working hard at digging down on where some of these issues are and how to improve them. There's a revitalized Maine Commission on Indigent Legal Services that's working hard to ensure that, you know, those defense attorneys who are being tapped to provide these services to individuals, that they are more than qualified and that they are doing the job that defendants deserve. What the structure ends up looking like, my hope is that, and by the way, this is not only because I want to make sure that there's a worthy adversary, if you will. So prosecutors need to be challenged by defense attorneys. I want that to happen. But as somebody who used to practice as a defense attorney and who acted as somebody who took indigent clients, it is so important that they get high quality legal representation, and whatever the structure looks like, it really needs to deliver that. So if that's a public defender system, if it's a hybrid system that, you know, maybe it makes sense in more urban areas to have a public defender system. But as you go out to the more rural areas where it might be harder to have a public defender's office, relying on the way it is now, whatever that system is, I'm confident that the legislature, the governor's office, the revitalized Maine Commission on Indigent Legal Services, defense attorneys, folks are working hard to make sure that when an indigent defendant needs an attorney, that they get somebody who's going to do everything they can to defend this individual.
We'll go to Jamie, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I am 12 years clean from substance use disorder, and I myself was in jail. I guess my question is like, you're, how much a day, do you know how much it costs per day for somebody to be jailed just without any medications or out any medical help that may be needed? As a, you know, because I saw firsthand many, many, many people would come in who were detoxing or, you know, withdrawing, and they would need to give them medicines. And I find it, I don't know, I just think, I just would like to know how much it costs per day to jail somebody.
So, so Jamie, good morning. I don't have the answer, but what I do know is that it's more than it would to jail somebody. It's going to cost more to do that than it's going to be to ensure that that individual has, remains in treatment, is able to continue with their, you know, either whether it be medication assisted treatment or counseling or what have you. So the calibration here is that to the extent that it is the case where it's just because of possession of drugs, if those people are indeed finding themselves jailed, I would agree with Megan Sway, Representative Warren, you, that it would be important that we direct that person if they're caught with drugs, be better if we can refer them to an appropriate treatment modality. That is where the criminal justice system might be best used to make that direction. But I'm agreeing that putting somebody in jail, interrupting potentially their treatment, and I saw this as a defense attorney, right? Having clients who are on a medication-assisted treatment went to jail for some reason, maybe not because of possession, but for some reason, it probably did cost a lot to manage that detox. And then when they were released, what did they do, right? Because they had to reestablish the network that was that they were relying upon for their treatment. So the goal here is to get people directed to appropriate abatement for their, you know, for what they need. And jail really has to be, if it's even a resort, a last resort in cases like this.
Jamie, thanks so much for calling and congratulations on the 12 years clean. We're going to go now to Nikita, who's calling from Washington County. Hi, Nikita. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm so glad to be speaking with you guys today. Thanks for having me. I guess first I just want to say I love what you're talking about with regards to the opioid crisis. I ended up in foster care because of what my mother dealt with opioid addiction, and I haven't really got a great sense of how this program works. So I wanted to start with that because it's been a few years, but sadly some of the consequences of the way that the state dealt with opioid crisis back then. I'm 28 now. I've been houseless now 5 times since I aged out of foster care. I had to put myself back into foster care when I was 16 years old after I was adopted. So I lived with one family for 8 years. And when I went to share some of the abuses that were going on, an incomplete investigation was done, contrary to the policies within DHHS. And I ended up in a hearing where I didn't have a lawyer or a guardian ad litem or anyone telling me about the $18 a day that I was considered to be valued at. And that was something that I had a right to protect me. So I ended up houseless at 19 years old. I've gone to college now 4 times. Both of the colleges that I attended shut their doors a year and a half ago before I could get into my last year. I also had to take on extra student loans because of the fact that I was in foster care and I had double the loan amounts and I couldn't say no to those extra loans. They are forced on foster kids to this day. It is not right. A year and a half ago, I was a delegate. I went to Washington. I went to the Capitol and I spoke with Nancy Pelosi. I spoke with the representative of New Hampshire. I even spoke with representative of Maine as a congressional delegate for former foster youth. And I just want to say that there needs to be a lot more oversight because I've spoken with the ombudsman. I've spoken with everyone about the Social Security regulated by the federal government that the state of Maine does not consider an asset and a right to the minor that it is in place for. They consider it an asset and a right to the guardian who gives up their own
guardianship, but somehow is able to control this subsidy into this young person growing into an adult. I've had the worst 10 years of my life.
Oh, Nikita, I'm so sorry. I'm so, so very sorry to hear what you've been through. And boy, my heart goes out to you. Aaron Fry, I know that some of what Nikita is talking about is not the department that you oversee. It sounds to me like a bunch of it's DHHS. But she did talk about not feeling represented in her hearings, not having an attorney, not having a guardian ad litem. Is that still going on?
Well, you know, a couple of different thoughts. You know, first of all, just like with Jamie, I appreciate Nikita calling in, both of them, you know, reaching out and providing very important information about what they're experiencing. And with respect to Nikita's concerns, it does show the concentric circles, right? The child protective system interacts with the opioid crisis, right? Interacts with criminal justice system, interacts with defense, right? The MCI main indigent defense, because you have parents who are represented by attorneys if they can't afford one. And what's challenging is that, you know, you really do need to hope that in these court hearings, there should have been an assistant attorney general representing the state. There should have been a parent's attorney representing the parents involved, but there should have also been a guardian ad litem, who is usually an attorney, but doesn't have to be, appointed by the court to look after the interests of somebody like Nikita. And it really is the job of the department's caseworker, so the Department of Health and Human Services caseworker, and the guardian ad litem to be helping not only look out for what the best interest of somebody like Nikita would be, but also ensuring that there's some direction for what happens when, you know, they age out of the system, or what resources might be available to them as a minor. So what's really unfortunate here is that it sounds like the systems that are set up to provide Nikita with that support, they let her down. You're right that, you know, my office is not the office that can address that the best. But certainly I took notes that I'm going to pass along to my child protection AGs and to, you know, my contacts at the department, because I know that, you know, under Commissioner Lambrou, there's a lot of work being done to try to improve the child protection system for all those involved. And I know that they'll be receptive to hearing what Nikita's experience was and checking to see if there are ways that there could be improvement.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Nikita, we've captured your phone number and we'll pass that on to Attorney General Fry. Thank you all so much for joining us today. And Aaron Fry, thank you for joining us for an hour on Maine Calling. Aaron is serving his second term as Attorney General for the state of Maine. Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith produce Maine Calling. KJ Akinmoladun was our sound engineer today. Cindy and Jonathan and KJ, thank you so much. Tomorrow on the show, join us for a listen back to our program about adult autism. It aired last year and was just chosen for a national award. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.